Is It Rolling Bob?
Talking Dylan.
He's your host, Lucas Hare.
He's your host, Kerry Shale.
But on the digital Bob phone, he's our guest, novelist, screenwriter, and journalist, Edward Docks.
I. In creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives. I. One says to the other, no man sees my face and lives. Took an untrodden path once, where the swift don't win the race. It goes to the worthy who can divide the word of truth. Took a stranger to teach me to look into justice's beautiful face and to see an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. I, in creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives, I. One says to the other, no man sees my face and lives. Outside of two men on a train platform, there's nobody in sight. They're waiting for spring to come, smoking down the track. The world could come to an end tonight, but that's all right. She should still be there sleeping when I get back. I, in creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives. I. One says to the other, no man sees my face and lives. Noontime, and I'm still pushing myself along the road, the darkest part, into the narrow lanes. I can't stumble or stay put. Someone else is speaking with my mouth, but I'm listening only to my heart. I've made shoes for everyone, even you. Will I still go barefoot? I, in creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives. I, one said to the other, no man sees my face and lives.
Whoa. Thanks, Ed. One of his lighter offerings. We're still waiting for springtime, aren't we? We're still waiting for noon. Why did you choose that brilliant piece of writing?
Many reasons. But first and foremost, because believe it or not, it was the first Dylan song I ever heard. And it changed my world, changed my universe, changed my thinking, changed everything. I was 14 years old. And I was actually on a campsite in northern Italy, traveling with my parents who used to drive us around Europe on these mad camping trips. I come from a very large family. I got six brothers and sisters. And I can't remember what it was. There'd been some very minor argument, probably about who was doing the washing up or something. So in an adolescent strop, I'd gone for a walk with my Walkman, and I'd just got a Walkman. It was very recent. And I had a tape. And I'd been listening to the tape a lot on the A side. But for some reason on this walk, I decided to put in the B side and hit reverse on the tape, as those of you who remember Walkmans will know you can do. And so I'm walking along this escarpment and I'm looking down to my left. And there's this incredible valley. This Aosta is in northern Italy, just as you come through the Mont Blanc tunnel. Mm-hmm. And it's twilight. And the sky really is sapphire. And you can see down into Italy through this valley. And I put this tape on and I hit play. And I hear the first bars of the song, I and I. And as you both know, that is just a life-changing moment. And it just starts with this great introduction of an incredibly rich and textured songwriter. And then we get to that chorus that I just read, I, in creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives, I. And here's the line that chills you. One said to the other, no man sees my face and lives. And I thought, what the hell is this? What is this music? This is off the scale. And I could not believe it. And I put it on again, and I just couldn't believe the depth and strength and beauty and layered wonder of the thing I was listening to. I had no idea what it was about. And from that day on, really, I have to say I found almost all other music far, far below that standard. And it was as if I personally had found the music that I've been looking for all through my sort of years of being 10, 11, 12, 13. And, you know, I've been listening to, my mum and dad gave me the Beatles, and I've been listening to the music everyone listens to, but I just not heard Dylan, or not consciously heard him. And then I put that on, and what a song it is.
That was going to be my question. What did you grow up listening to? But and how did you find, in that case, how did you happen to have that on your...
That's what I want to know. What was it doing on side two? Yeah. Why that one first?
Well, it was amazing. I mean, I used to get the bus to school. I went to school in the center of Manchester, and there was a kind of group of seven or eight of us who would sit near the back, and we'd listen to music because it was quite a long ride into Manchester, about an hour. And we'd have different tapes and different music. And there was a kid, and I can't even remember his name, and he was younger than me. And he'd had a tape that I'd wanted to borrow for what was on the other side. And I think that was a Talking Heads mixtape, to be honest. And I'd just been listening to that, and he'd lent me this compilation tape. And it was his dad's. And he didn't even know what this stuff on the other side of the tape was. And of course, in those days, it wasn't so quick to find out. But I took the tape out and saw it was Infidels. It said Infidels Dylan. And the first thing I did when I got back from my holidays is bought that album. And what an album it is. But what a song it is. I mean, it's about so much. It's a sort of, I mean, I just thought, which songwriter writes a chorus like that? You know, I and I in creation where one's nature neither honors nor forgives. I and I, one says to the other. I just thought, what great human being has written this down? And I just couldn't wait to find out. And of course, now I know much more what the song's about. And it bounces through the kind of the citation of Exodus, from Exodus in the Old Testament, where God refers to himself as the I am, and I am. And it comes through the Rastafarian idea of I and I, and meaning a human consciousness in oneself, and also human consciousness as bodied in God. And you know, the song's about this incredible confrontation with reality and existential misgiving and art. And like all great Dylan work, it's both mystical, it's religious, it's very physical, it's about a woman, it's about his own work, it's about something very, very intelligent. It's an amazing song, and it's still one of my favorites. It's still one of my favorites.
I can only think that you must have been quite a precocious 14-year-old. Not a lot of 14-year-olds, I think, would respond to that particular Dylan song. You know, there's much more accessible songs.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was always really super, super keen on English and the English language. And I in fact, went on to read English at university and formed a band called The Infidels. And made it my mission to make all those bastards listen to endless, endless covers. And I used to write a magazine for the college. And each week, the magazine would just have loads of Dylan quotes on. I didn't care. They were going to come with... I've converted quite a few, by the way. They hated it, but they're coming with me. And one by one, they fought. Even now, many years later, I get little emails saying, you know, Ed, you were right. I've just started listening. I took a couple of them to the concerts. But I was always really, really into language and poetry, and the thing that's amazing and puts Dylan up there with Shakespeare and Donne and others is that he has this incredible facility, this incredible poetic facility, which is able, on the same line, to render the inner spiritual experience, the inner physical experience, lust, that kind of stuff, as well as a very kind of human experience. And there's just so few poets that have all three gifts operative simultaneously. And that's the thing about him. I mean, a lot of people, you can read Byron for lust. You can read Wordsworth for nature. You can read T.S. Eliot for intellectual stuff. But I'd never found anyone who, apart, I think, from Shakespeare, who is such a virtuoso of all three at the same time, and somehow manages to make those lines both capacious and at the same time narrowly meaningful. And I just couldn't believe it. I thought it was, I mean, the next song is terrible, I must say.
That was going to be my question, made of the entire album.
Well, I don't like Union Sundown. I think it's a clumsy Dylan song, I think. Mm. And it's one of those albums. I mean, you guys both know, I'm sure, the lineup is kind of interesting because Mark Knopfler plays the lead guitar. The bass and drums are from Bob Marley's band. That's right.
Yeah,
and and it's a kind of, it's got some, I think, of Dylan's very greatest work. I mean, you'll both know Joker Man, of course, and I'm sure you both love that. But it's also, it's not coherent in the sense of Modern Times or Oh Mercy or Highway 61. But I think it reaches, I would put two or three of the songs certainly in the top 20. It's got some of his best work on it. But that's how it got started for me. That was Infidels, and that's where I began.
And then there's Neighborhood Bully.
Oh.
You know, well, I know I can stand up for Neighborhood Bully, guys. Go. Well, you know, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but I think actually he's very passionate when he sings it. It's a good tune. And at the time, it was, to me, it was a relief from the Jesus songs. That's all, you know, I don't think it's a great song, and I certainly don't think it's dated well, but he's written much worse.
I wonder if there's a playlist of Dylan songs that we can reasonably define as dodgy as fuck. Is Your Love in Vain possibly in that? I don't know.
See, I think Is Your Love in Vain is dodgier as far as I'm concerned.
Well, we're gonna have to come on to Street Legal because I'm just not gonna let either of you try even for a minute.
You said that you think Street Legal might be in his top two albums, which I would love to hear you talk more about.
I mean, Street Legal is the moment in Dylan's career when it all comes down to it. And I think that the passage through the 70s, you know, the false flag of New Morning, and then the kind of, I don't know, the feeling in Blood on the Tracks, that there is blood on the tracks, and then the kind of Spanish inflected Desire, and all of that blood on the tracks really leads to Street Legal. And in Street Legal, you get this incredible moment where everything coheres, but in a dark way. So it's a deeply religious or spiritual, and yet it's about the absence of God. You know, that song, Señor, where is the God that he's appealing to? Nowhere to be seen. The journey through dark heat. And at the same time, this kind of dark eroticism with New Pony. And then on top of all that, this kind of utter sense of abandonment. And I think he reaches in Street Legal a synthesis of his gifts, albeit played in such a dark and grim for him way that he never gets to again, I don't think, till maybe Modern Times or Rough and Rowdy Ways, too soon to know about that. But that's the album where, in a strange way, the masks are off. I know with Dylan, masks mean many things and masks are always on. But what I mean by that is that's as close as you get to this great artist's soul burning out of an album.
You know, I hate to disagree with a guest so early in the show, but Street Legal to me is an album that I like the individual songs, and I love some of the individual songs, but I was thinking about this today. Some songs or even some albums you listen to and you love instantly, and some you don't. Like, some are beautiful to you and highly charged. When I heard Changing the Guards, I thought, ugh, God, what an ugly song. I found the arrangements ugly. I found the female backing singers ultimately tedious. Like, I thought the first couple of minutes, I thought, yeah, sure. Like every song on Street Legal, the first couple of minutes I go, yeah, sure. And by the end, I'm drained. And that doesn't happen to me with Blood on the Tracks. That doesn't happen to me with New Morning, which you just a little bit sort of threw away. I love New Morning. But of course, it's not in the same league as Street Legal as far as depth. But, you know, you can grow to love something. And I tried to. I listened to Street Legal a number of times since we knew we were going to have you on the show. And I still find it kind of exhausting and a bit embarrassing.
Oh, listen, the first one I'm certainly not going to disagree with. This is Dylan's Bosworth. This is after the battle. He's walking around a battlefield and there's blood and corpses and death and everything's gone wrong and his career's over and he can't sing and there is no God and there is no woman and there's nothing and he can't even play very well. It's just terrible. But somehow, in this darkness, he picks himself up and he starts to sing. And he sings 16 Years. And what an amazing song that is. Because really what it's about is, I've come all this way and I've now been taken off my horse and cut to ribbons, and I somehow have to rebuild. And you can feel the absence of God in that album, and you can feel his spirit desperate, thirsty. This is the Valley of Dry Bone Dreams. This is the end of the road. This is the place where I don't think he ever even dared go there again. It was so bleak. So exhausting, absolutely. Embarrassing, no. I think it's beyond embarrassment. It's not really something he's got control. Embarrassing is things like the bad tracks on Knocked Out Loaded, or where he completely ballses up Empire Burlesque. That's embarrassing. Mm-hmm. Because embarrassment suggests a degree of control almost. But in Street Legal, he's got no control. It's just, I mean, I fought with my twin, the enemy within, till both of us fell by the road. There's no one left standing in that album. And I don't mean to say, in a way, it's my favorite album. I don't even mean to say it's the one that I listen to the most. It probably isn't. But it's the one where I feel greatest kinship with his artistic defeat. And I think that honesty doesn't come. I don't think he's as defeated again. The next time he's defeated, which is Down in the Groove, he doesn't try. He leaves the battlefield and says, I'm going to have a cup of tea. But in Street Legal, he's not dead yet.
Well, that's beautifully put. I couldn't, I couldn't argue with that. With the exception, I think, of Is Your Love in Vain, which I think is embarrassing and stands the test of time as a song in which I am embarrassed for him. But it's honest. There's no way it's not honest. And, you know, I take my hat off to him for that. But isn't an album, what is the album that you go to? I'm interested. Because I don't go to Street Legal, and I probably won't go to it again for quite a while, for my Bob Dylan fix. You know, some days my Bob Dylan fix is one of the early ones. Some days it's Highway 61. Some days it's Together Through Life, which I think is a very listenable album. What's your go-to?
Well, I mean, I've become one of those people who, it's so profoundly in me that I don't, if you ask me how does it feel, it feels like communing with somebody who in all seriousness is trying to figure out something incredibly profound about what it means to be a human being, and doing that through the medium of poetry, and actually through the medium of sung poetry. And so what I've done to myself is I have a kind of rule, which is kind of strange, but I stick to it, which is I have the whole of Dylan on shuffle. And I do it for precisely the reason you sort of intimated there, which is
right.
I don't want to have something I'm not going to listen to. And I know if it leave it up to me, I'll choose stuff. I'll choose albums and I won't go to. But if you have it on shuffle and suddenly, I don't know, let me think of a good example.
Ugliest Girl in the World.
Yeah, Ugliest Girl in the World comes on. And you've got this deal with yourself. You've got to listen to it. There's Ed. You've got to listen to it, man. You're not getting out of it. That's what we're listening to. And then you have to. And you know what? You get so much from that because you suddenly hear it. I mean, I know because I've read so much about him and I've read all the books about him. He's having. I mean, I think that was the worst time for him creatively. And I read this terrible book by someone who was one of his girlfriends then. And it was just desperate. But it was desperate without even the kind of grandeur of Street Legal. It was just, you know, I always think of Dylan as this great train ride across America. So let's just say for a moment, bear with me on the metaphor, but you're going from New York to Los Angeles. And I think one of the mistakes a lot of people make is you have to be on the whole ride because, of course, some of it is going to be deathly boring as you go through the suburbs of some very minor town and look out over factories and back alleys. And then the rest, of, you know, other bits would be amazing. But I think Knocked Out Loaded in that period at the end of the 80s is the only time when Dylan himself just does not know what to do. And so rather than put those songs off my radar, I stick them on the playlist. And you know what? They come up. I mean, I was listening to My God, They Killed Him, the Mahatma Gandhi song the other day. And it's like, wow, this is so bad. But it's never that bad. It's always interesting. And I was thinking, you know, this is really about him again, isn't it? Of course, it's about Jesus, about Dylan. It's about, Oh, and I was thinking, wow. And then I was thinking about those lines from I and I, in fact. I can't stumble or stay put. And I realized the problem he had in that period, in, kind of 86 to 88, is he stayed put. And then he talks, I think, in an interview about playing somewhere in Switzerland when he and he was hiding behind his backing singers, he says. Mm-hmm. And he suddenly had a vision. And the vision, he says, was that he had to not stay put. He had to keep moving. He had to keep going. And I think you see that with Oh Mercy, which I think is an underrated album. I think Oh Mercy is top five.
And, yeah, and I adore that album. And when, yeah. when somebody says it's okay, I really have to bite my lip because I think it's just
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah, I mean, and he comes back and he keeps moving again. But sorry, this is a long answer. I have them all on shuffle for the reason that if Dogs comes free on, then I'm just gonna have to listen to it. And there are lots of songs I don't like. I mean, there are lots of songs. I don't know how many he's written, but there's at least a third of his work that is not great. But it's always interesting.
Well, it's like if you have. I mean, I think there is no purer joy in musical terms than when a song you love comes on the radio. And you hear it with different ears. You had no sense of expectation. You have no sense of context. It's someone else's decision and you're not ready for it. And it leaps out of the speakers and it exists only on its own terms. And I think you can do that with Dylan's output. Absolutely. If you put it on shuffle, and I'm looking now at my 94-hour Spotify playlist that...
Available through our Spotify.
My attempt to chronicle 1,350 songs into order of recording, and you put that on shuffle and Clean Cut Kid comes along or something, and you think, well, that's not so bad. And it's particularly not so bad because I've not listened to three or four songs on Empire Burlesque already, and I'm depressed, you know, and I'm railing against mid-80s production because it just exists by itself. And it's a really, really instructive way to reevaluate art without sounding too pretentious, I think.
No, I totally agree. I listened to Dink's song today, which came up on some shuffle thing, Dylan's version of Dink's song. And I had recently re-seen Inside Llewyn Davis and heard the beautifully, you know, recorded Marcus Mumford, Oscar Isaac version from the soundtrack album. And I remember I was listening to that a number of times because it was so beautiful. Dylan's version wipes the floor with that. It's so simple and rhythmic, and Dylan's voice, that's what it really is. They can't touch Dylan's voice with their beauty and their on-key singing. Speaking of, I'm going to lead in, Ed. I've taken something from your website about Dylan's singing voice, which we can all listen to as I recite it from your article, and then we can discuss it. It's about Dylan's voice. Imagine an Old Testament prophet come down from the mountains of the desert. Imagine he has 70 years' worth of visions to impart. In rich and vivid verse, visions comprised for the most part of searing and timeless human truth about love and God and man. But imagine that he has neither heard nor spoken a single word during his many decades alone, that his voice is therefore as cracked as the tablets he bears and as croaky as the rocks among which he has lived, and that furthermore, he has no sense of the speed nor the sound, nor the stresses, nor the syntax of conventional speech. Now, imagine that a joker selling ecstasy tablets and helium balloons has waylaid him on the way to the amphitheater. And finally, imagine that when he, at last, steps up before you to discourse upon what is undoubtedly the quintessence of existence, he chooses to do so by intoning through a hookah pipe, using only the five notes of the pentatonic scale. That is what I mean by Dylan singing. Those are your words.
That's kind of it, isn't it? That's kind of it. I mean, it's so amazing and bad and wonderful and exhilarating. I mean, one of the great joys and pleasures of my life is going to concerts with people who've either only seen him once or not seen him at all and just watching their faces. he stumbles out looking like, you know, like King Lear in some really minor play set in the deep south. Some old man who's usually plays the fool has been asked to play King Lear, and he's punch drunk because he's been boxing all day and drinking and sobered up. And then he kind of staggers out from the side, and he's much shorter, and kind of his hair's like this kind of weird cockatoo Frizz Crown, and he can't find his harmonicas, and he doesn't know when his guitar is, and he walks past the mic like he's never seen one in his life, and the band's all playing the wrong notes, and no one knows what the hell is going on, and it's pitch dark, and then suddenly somewhere a spotlight comes on, and he stands forward and he says something like, "I and I," and you just like, "Whoa, what?" And no one knows what song it is, and the band's lost and he's lost. And then gradually everything comes into focus and you watch this man. You know, the concerts, I've been to hundreds, and they're just, for me, it's religious. It's like going to church. I mean, I'm completely not religious. This is the closest I come, but it's, you know, some days it's awful. I've been to some baddies, some real baddies, but the days that it's good, it's off the scale good. He, you know, I often think that what's going on is that he's trying to conjure the ghosts of Dylan past. And sometimes he can bring, I mean, I saw him play the song we opened with, I and I, in Manchester in, I think, 94, with this drummer guy called Winston Watson playing on the drums. You know, he gets to that line, "No man sees my face and lives." And you just think, and it's God speaking to man, and man speaking back to God, and you can hear the Bible, and you can hear God. So God saying to Moses, "No man sees my face and lives," and you feel like you're watching this Old Testament prophet, incandescent with existence and rage, addressing the heavens and saying, "Listen, gods, what on earth are you doing? What is it? What have you done to us? We're abandoned down here." So you see these moments of deep, serious artistic transcendence, the kind of stuff you get with a great Shakespeare play. It's very like Shakespeare plays, actually, now I think of it. Again, I've been to dozens, and you get really bad versions and you get really amazing, mesmerizing versions, often of the same play. But what's always good, just like with Shakespeare, is the words. So even in a bad Shakespeare, you can just fall back on listening to what's being said, even if it's not being done well. And it's the same with Dylan. I mean, sometimes he wakes up during songs in live performance and suddenly thinks, "Wow, that's a good line. And it means this other thing than I thought it meant." And one of the amazing things about it is that the songs change meanings for both audience and performer through 20 years of performance. You know, I remember, I think in that same piece that you've quoted, I was talking about This Wheel's on Fire, which was written, you know, many, many decades ago, and can't have meant what it did mean in that concert in the 90s at Bournemouth. Yeah. And what it meant in that concert was, "I promised you I'd be back. I promised you I'd sing to you again. I promised you I'd give you more of this truth, this poetic truth, and here I am doing it." And you think, how the hell could what he sang then mean so much to us now? And there's a great communality in watching Dylan live as well, which is that you're all kind of there together, and you're as lost as he is and as found as he is. And I love that. I love that. I mean, it's an impossible thing to explain to someone who's not experienced it, because you sort of have to go a few times before it begins to dawn on you what you're seeing.
One of the things that I don't understand is how he can play. There's a lot of people out there at every concert who are, for lack of a better word, idiots. Like the guy in front of us, Luke. Do you remember we went to see him at Wembley? Yeah. And it was about three quarters of the way through the concert. The band was really going, and it was maybe not one of the top concerts ever, but he was doing a good job, and they were doing good work, and it was absolutely riveting. And the guy in front of us went up. He was in the middle of the row. And went out and got some fries with cheese, you know, some melted cheese fries.
What are you doing here?
You know, what are you doing there? And he's got to play to these idiots as well as, you know, people like us who are actually listening. I find that even more extraordinary that he, you know, he goes out of his way even to play to the idiots.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's more to do with venues. I mean, there are people out there who think that the Bob Dylan live experience is not complete without a paper plate full of, you know, rancid nachos. I've been on stage and come out and smelt popcorn after the interval and thought, what the fuck? You know? I don't know if you've heard this line, Ed. There's a theatre director called Nate Markovich. I follow him on Twitter. But he said something which I found early in the year. And he said, "Shakespeareans, do you want to know how to nail a caesura, make a rhyming couplet sound tough, and consistently surprise an audience who already knows all the words? Listen to Bob Dylan." And I just thought that was perfect. And that really, really taps into what you're saying, that there is a degree of familiarity. But and as you say, this it can be bad and good at the same time. But it's a really, really valid comparison, I think.
Well, I think the thing is, for him, is he's refiguring and reinvigorating the week. I mean, one of the things I've written about for the newspapers is just the simple, extraordinary artistic dynamism. And by that, I mean, not only has he written 39 studio albums, but imagine for a minute that I said to you, okay, guys, this year we're going to perform live singing for 100 nights of the year. And we're going to charge people a lot of money, right? So we're going to have to be somewhat good. And then next year, you know what we're doing? We're doing that again. And you know what we're doing the year after that? We're doing that again. And we're doing it from almost 30 years of that, 100 nights. And you've got to do it just imagine the travel and the logistics, soul spend to even get yourself on stage. And to do that at the level that he does it is extraordinary. And that kind of tremendous imaginative power that he brings to reinterpretation, that's where his vitality is. Because unlike Mick Jagger, which is essentially a museum act, or Paul McCartney, who's kind of well-meaning but not profound, Dylan knows that he can find things in the stuff he's written every night. And some nights he definitely doesn't. But on the nights that he does, he's bringing this tremendous imaginative power to self-revelation in order to find again something truthful to share with you, something that's full of feeling and insight, but something that's not delivered at the expense of intelligence or subtlety or wit. And that's because he's forcefully and seriously engaged with the quiddity of life, with the real business of life. And I think that that's what makes him Shakespearean. It's a similar kind of massive, lifelong, serious engagement with human truth, with love, with death, with spirituality, the bridge in between. And that's what you're there for. That's what you're watching. And he has to find it too. It's in his words. It's always written in, because as you know, he packs his writing from all over, you know, from the Old Testament. There's tons of Ovid in it. I mean, if you listen to something like As I Went Out This Morning, it's almost word for word Ovid. But then there's the Rastafarian stuff I've just talked about. And then there's all the Christian stuff. And then there's endless iterations of the poets that he reads. So the work is so rich that when he's up there in the lights, trying to find his way through the Old Testament storm, he just suddenly, the lights go on and he gets it, and you hear some, I'm sure you both know this, but the funny feeling you get when you hear a Dylan line, and I've never understood that before. Of course it's about that. Mm. It's not about what I thought, it's about that. And that's like Shakespeare, you know, you're halfway through a Hamlet soliloquy and you think, of course I'm an idiot. Yeah. It was about that all along.
And I think that the other thing that reminds me of Shakespeare is, if you see a bad one, you still go back. I mean, the first time I saw Dylan was in 1991 in Hammersmith. He was awful. There's no two ways about it. He was utterly appalling. I went again 2 years later, and then 3 years later, and then 1 year later. And he progressively got better and better for about 10, 15 years. But I was thinking to myself, is there another performer where I'd do this, where they started off the worst thing I'd ever seen, and I'd still go back willing them to get better because I could see that they had it in them to do so?
I saw him once. I can't remember what. I saw all those Hammersmith shows in 90 and 91, and then in 93, I think he was back.
Yeah.
And I saw him come on, and he'd obviously just lost the harmonica key that he needed. He couldn't find it. I don't know if it was G or C or whatever it was. He just couldn't find it. And he'd been pottering about, you know how he sort of potters about in the semi-darkness.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't find it. And so the band were playing, and they'd been on the third loop through, and no one knew what was going on. And then he found a harmonica and started to blow it. But it was clearly the wrong key. And you could see the band like slightly thinking, do we switch key, switch song, stop, start, what do we do? And he just started playing the whole thing in the wrong key, and they all started to move around. And then he gave up. He just took the harmonica out, put it back down again, everyone back into the same key and start playing it again. It was just unbelievable.
Well, you can do that. I mean, I think that the King Curtis's saxophone solo in Respect is in a different key from the rest of the song. I mean, these things can work. But fuck,
or you can be like Van Morrison. I saw Van Morrison once say, he said, this is the wrong key. Harp, bring me another harp, and started yelling at his roadies, and people were scrambling around, and he never did get the you know, the right one, and probably, well, you know, the apocryphal story about people, the roadies doing unspeakable things to Van Morrison's equipment, a harp. But anyway, he just, it was chaos, but bad chaos. It wasn't entertaining chaos. In fact, he lost the audience. Whereas Dylan, when he does that, you're on the edge of your seat.
Yeah, you're leaning in. You're like, you're waiting for him to find it. I remember, I can't remember which concert it was, when he was playing Don't Think Twice, and I heard that song for the first time. And I thought, not for the first time, sorry, I mean, I heard the line, what it meant for the first, and I suddenly realized it meant, you know, and this is the other thing that binds him to Shakespeare and Donne and these, and the great, great writers, is he got four meanings out of a single line. So he got, you know, do think twice, it's all right. Do think twice, it's not all right. Don't think twice, it's all right. And don't think twice, it's not all right. And you could feel all four meanings present as he sang it. And it suddenly dawned on him what an amazing line that is as well. It's all in the delivery.
That's the wonderful thing about seeing him live, is when something makes Dylan smile, to me, it's like the skies part and it's sunny all of a sudden. Somebody was banging out a really fabulous organ solo in concert, but Dylan's eyes lit up and he grinned from ear to ear for a long time. And he was sort of bopping along and just really enjoying himself. And, you know, Bob doesn't allow himself, I think, the luxury of showing the audience his enjoyment. That's very rare. Mm. And so when you see it, it's just, he loves us, or, you know, there's something so wonderful. It just to see that on a grainy YouTube video absolutely made my day.
It's that feeling like when he makes a joke on Theme Time Radio Hour or something, isn't it? It just brings him back down to earth again.
Well, I mean, I've almost done myself physical damage when he jokes on Theme Time Radio Hour. I throw my head back and, you know, hit it on the wall, because it's so funny to hear, just to hear. It's like God joking.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is like that. But he's so warm and wry and collusive and intimate. And you get a sound of what he must be like to talk to. And I think that's all there. I mean, I think the reason that he's so distant on the shows is just because he does 100 of them, you know, a year, and he's 75, or he's nearly 80 now, of course. But, you know, he can't give himself that much.
I agree. But, you know, the difference between, like, I've always, it's my contention that Dylan is for most of the time, a terrible film actor. He's a terrible actor because he can't and won't, and somehow he's just incapable of replicating fake behavior. And so, whereas Luke and I are both actors, and I've done shows with people that I've not gotten along with, miserable tours, but my character was supposed to be enjoying themselves. So people would say to me after the show, God, you were really enjoying yourself out there, weren't you? And I wouldn't say, no, I'm a fucking brilliant actor, but I was acting, you know, but they, you know, didn't see that, and I wasn't going to correct them. But Dylan can't do that. He's, because the thing that you're doing when you're an actor is you're concentrating really hard at pretending that you're someone else, and that your exterior is different from your interior. Your interior is thinking, oh, the audience, you know, I'll turn this way, I'll hit the light, that person is too far upstage, whatever. But Dylan can't and won't do that. So consequently, you rarely see him enjoying himself in the way an audience wants him to enjoy himself, in the way that Frank Sinatra would pretend that he was enjoying himself when he was doing his 100th concert.
Yeah, I think the thing about Dylan that we're kind of circling here is there's a deep authenticity that comes with his work, which is not, and by that I mean, I don't mean a straightforward quotidian not telling the truth, because as we all know, he's an infamous liar and indeed has invented the person of Bob Dylan. But what I mean by authenticity is that he is a tremendously powerful reporter from the front line of his own experience, and doesn't flinch in that business. And that might mean that his own experience is deeply in love. It might mean he's deeply in sorrow. It might mean that he's just found Jesus. It might mean that he hates Jesus. It might mean that he's gone to New Orleans and found a new way of singing. It might mean that he's writing Together Through Life. It might mean any number of things, but he opens his veins and he says, this is what it's like for me now. And in a way that I don't think almost any other artist does. I mean, people like Bowie and Tom Waits and those guys, all of whom I love, are acts. Lou Reed, I think, even in a way that Dylan's not. And even Leonard Cohen, who's perhaps the closest peer that he has, the persona of sonneteering lover is a persona. Whereas for Dylan, the authenticity is inheres so deeply that it's not really acting, it's something else. It's to do with inhabiting himself as a transmitter of what he believes to be true, however that needs to be done. And that is something that I think really kind of carves him out, this incredible, authentic turning up with the truth. I mean, one of the things I wrote about years ago was I just always find it, you guys are both actors, I'm a writer. One of the things I find amazing is to keep working. You know, I mean, if I write a book, and it hasn't really happened, but I've had a couple of not great reviews, you feel bad because you think, well, now the whole public has read this, and, you know, my mom's read it, and my wife's read it, and all the, and of course you pick yourself up and you go again. But to do that 39 times after you've been traduced in the most vile way, time and time and time again, I just find that extraordinary, the way he just says, okay, well, I'll do another album then. How you do that, I don't know.
Well, it must take enormous confidence and security. And I mean, it's almost like, the thing I love about Dylan more than anything, I think, is that he never feels he has to talk about the work. He always, always feels that the work will stand for itself. That, you know, that explains all his cryptic mid-60s responses to journalists. He will never, I mean, with occasional exceptions, like in the liner notes of World Gone Wrong, he'll never sit down and specifically and methodically go through the songs, but they were other people's songs. I suppose that's why. But I was listening at the weekend to one of those tracks, which has been quite difficult to get over the last few years, but now has appeared on Spotify, which is the version on the elusive disc 3 of Telltale Signs of Can't Wait, that sounds a bit like Pink Floyd. Mm-hmm. And I'd never really listened to it properly before, but it's absolutely that. It's absolutely that opening his veins. The desolation in that song is, for the 6 or 7 minutes of the song's duration, seemed unparalleled in his canon. And yet this is a relatively obscure outtake from an album recorded 23 years ago, the third different version of it that only some people paid for at the time. And he's content to just let that rise to the surface one day.
It was really sad when he stopped trusting himself until, you know, he wrote the song Trust Yourself on Empire Burlesque. And I think that was possibly directed at himself. Because
of course
he was lost, and it's really sad when Dylan becomes inauthentic. Which I think the songs on, say, here's the, you know, Empire Burlesque discussion. The songs are, a lot of them are fabulous, but the, you know, he didn't trust himself enough to put his foot down about the god awful production.
Empire Burlesque is also, I think, an underrated album. I think there's a lot on there that's tremendous lyrically. But as you've just said, I think what happens when he comes to record that is he doesn't know where to go musically. He's done what he's done and he's found his way and he's brought Mark Knopfler in to do Infidels. And Infidels, I think, has, I know not everyone likes it, but I think it has a very cohesive atmospheric sound. Mm-hmm. And I think with Empire Burlesque, you've got just a man thrashing about musically. Everything, I mean, if you think about Dark Eyes and the difference between that and When the Sky Comes Falling, I mean how can they be on the same,
falling from the sky?
And yet you can still hear, this is why there's no uninteresting Dylan album, you can still hear tremendous authenticity in Dark Eyes and in When the Sky Comes Falling. You can hear him, the production's ruining it, but you can hear him, you know, I set my feelings down in a letter when you were gambling for support. He means it. He absolutely, when he wrote that, he meant it. And that's that. I'll Remember You as well, which is it's a funny song because it sometimes comes on my famous Dylan Shuffle and I think, oh God, really? I've got to listen to this. Other times I'm in the mood. You know, I've heard some people say it was written about, I don't know the truth of this, by the way. Some people say it was about Elizabeth Taylor. Some people about his dad. I don't know. But if you get that song on the right day when you can physically take it because it's so to the bone, then it's an amazing song. But on other days you think, oh, it's soupy and But it's I think he's very, very rarely naff, which is a strange English word, but I think he's never that. It's sometimes misbegotten, but I can't think of a song. I mean, I would even defend Is Your Love in Vain. I don't think there's a song where I think, come on, man. There's always a reason that he gets to the page. There's a truth there. There's something he wants to say. There's a powerful, artistic, lyrical endeavor behind what he's trying to say.
Luke sent me, just before we went on the air here, he sent me a link to the Masked and Anonymous version of I Remember You, which isn't on the album, which is just in the rather terrible movie. And it's heartbreaking. Mm. It's fabulous. Totally reveals the song. I really recommend that to anybody. And it proves what you just said, Ed, that, I mean, it really is. It's a deep, beautiful, just gut-wrenching version, as opposed to the original.
You know what about Empire Burlesque? Something's just occurred to me. I wonder how influenced he was by Bruce Springsteen. Born in the USA came out the year before and is one of Bruce Springsteen's most successful albums. And I'm going to get some stick for saying this, but the production on most of it is pretty horrible. But the songs are some of the darkest, bleakest songs. And they're all purposefully dressed up in upbeat melodies. I mean, all the songs on Born in the USA are about rejection, desolation, failed dreams, failure in general. And even a song like Glory Days is about looking back on the fact that the glory days have passed. And, you know, and it's all dressed up in this very poppy, very mid-80s production. And it was incredibly successful. And I wonder if he thought he could do that. I don't know.
Well, he must have. I mean, he hired Arthur Brown and he knew what he could do. So, and he was keen for a hit, wasn't he?
I'm going to let you correct yourself to Arthur Baker so I can,
sorry. Edit. Yes, Arthur Brown.
I was going to come in.
No, I'm going to say it. Well, he hired Arthur Baker, so he knew what he was doing, right?
There's no way that's going to be editable. You're laughing.
No, just cut it.
But I think there's, you know, you hear another song on that album that I think is... It again on the Great Dylan Shuffle comes on and my heart leaps. I love it when it comes on, almost because I wouldn't play it of my own volition, is the title track, you know, Tight Connection to My Heart, which I know he has done many recordings of. But if we just go with the album recording, you just hear that. I can still hear his voice crying in the wilderness. What looks large from a distance, close up, ain't never that big. You see and hear him, you know, all of that Jesus stuff and all of that born again stuff. And then the sort of new Zionism of infidels, he can still hear his voice crying in the wilderness. And it's really, as so often with Dylan, his own voice crying in the wilderness. And it's the wilderness of uncreativity. He doesn't know what to do. And yet, even though he doesn't know what to do, there's something about that song which... I must be guilty of something. You just whisper it into my ear. There's something so... Do you know those Browning poems? I can't remember off the top of my head, but where they're like dramatic monologues. It's like he's talking to you, but kind of talking to someone else. It's a mesmerizing song, I think.
I think you've hit upon a connection actually as well between Street Legal and Empire Burlesque. That there is a similar quality to both those albums, which I hadn't fully appreciated before. And I think that 16 years that he talks about at the beginning of Street Legal, it's not often in his career that he openly refers to his own career. But 16 years before 1978 is 1962.
That's right.
You know,
that's
that is right. The length, yeah, of his career. And those are the opening words. And he's quite clearly saying, this is me on some level, isn't he? And I think there's a degree of that, although more buried in Empire Burlesque.
Ed, you referred 10 minutes ago to Together Through Life. And I'd just like to squeeze that in because it's an album that's very rarely sort of mentioned anymore, although it was quite big when it came out. And I think there's a lot of good stuff on it. And it was recorded 30 years, I realized, after Street Legal. And he'd stopped, you know, he was no longer in that dark place. He, to me, Together Through Life, I think the reason I put it on just on a, you know, relaxed day, not that there isn't heavy stuff in it, but there's a lot of relaxed stuff in it, that he's the sort of guy, he's become, age 67 when it came out, the sort of guy that you could imagine having a funny radio show and having a drink with. What do you make of it?
Well, I mean, I seem to be, my purpose on this podcast seems to be just sticking up for the albums everyone else is down on. So I'm now going to stick up for Together Through Life. I think it's, like all Dylan's work, absolutely rivetingly interesting. And I think Here's the thing, right? If you go, as I did, to some of the shows in the later 90s, and you hear him play, for example, Forgetful Heart, and you hear that drum, and you know that drum's kind of his heart, and you know that he knows the number of beats left is limited, and you hear him address his own heart, and he stands there like some Old Testament prophet, and he starts to sing, and he says, "Forgetful heart, lost your power of recall," and the sneer in that, every little detail, you don't remember at all the times we knew. Who would remember better than you? And it's so direct, so to himself, so full of that grandiloquent sneering, but at his own expense, and so dark and so lost. And then he kind of comes round, and he's sort of going through the verse, and he always stands up right at the front when he sings this. He puffs his chest out if you watch him. And he goes, you know, it's been so long. Now you're content to let the days go by, i.e. you're not writing good songs. When you were there, you were the answer to my prayer, Forgetful Heart. And it's a companion song, I think, to Heart of Mine. I love it when he talks to his own heart. And it's about precisely what you're talking about, which is, has he lost it again? And I think that song lifts the whole album. But I would also absolutely defend three or four other songs on that. I mean, I think Beyond Here Lies Nothing is a tremendous song. I don't love the music again, but it's got this kind of, I don't know, it's got a kind of, what does he sing? I'm trying to remember the words now. My ship is in the harbor and the sails are spread. Listen to me, pretty baby, lay your hand upon my head. It's like, I'm ready for death. There's a lot more darkness in there. There's another line about the mountains of the past. Mm. He's talking, as he's always talking, about his own work. And the thing about a Dylan album, which is a kind of 6 or 7 on 10, is we're always talking about them. If we go backwards, there's Modern Times, which I think is in the top 5. And then if you go forwards, there's now Rough and Rowdy Ways. So, of course, we're sort of slightly down on Together Through Life. But if anybody else had written even one of those songs, we'd all be having babies for them. It'd be like, wow, he's really woken up. Oh, my God, Neil Young's back, or whoever it would be. Whereas for Dylan, we just kind of take it for granted. I think the great Dylan shuffle thing, I feel a change coming on, comes on, the last part of the day is already gone. And the way he says that, the way he sings that, and he keeps saying it, it's like an incantation. And I think it's an album much more, weirdly, much more about death than people think, because it's jaunty. But actually, it's Dylan talking very much as though, ain't no use in dreaming, I've got better things to do. Dreams never worked out anyway, even when they did come true. He's talking about his whole life, and he's preparing to die, I think, in it. As I think he is in a lot of these albums in the last 10 years. But I really like Together Through Life. And I think it's one of those albums which, you both must know this weird feeling, man, when you're, you know, 30 years of your life pass and someone makes you listen to, I don't know, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. I haven't listened to that album for 20 years. And you sit down and you listen to it and you think, oh my God, it's much better than I thought. Or suddenly you get to the end of Under the Red Sky and you've not listened to that for ages. You think, it's not as good as I remember. And the thing about Dylan's work where you have to be humble in a way is you never really know if it's any good till years pass. I mean, I didn't really love Street Legal until I began to think upon his plight and see him in the battlefield, see him in the battlefield of his own life. And see him laying down low in the reeds without any oxygen. When I started to hear what he was saying, my admiration for him went up. And Together Through Life is a bit like that. I think the jauntiness of the music is the thing that takes us away from... It's similar to Empire Burlesque, actually, now we're talking about that. The music is not commensurate, I think, with the words, or not always.
Yeah, they don't always fit. To me, it's like, when he went and studied with Norman Rayburn. Yeah. And he learned how everything exists at once and looking at different angles and time and is a construct. But the music is like that, I think, on Empire Burlesque. And it's very difficult for me to get through that for Empire Burlesque. You know, I try to listen, but after about the problem with listening to Dylan album all the way through, it's actually a big mistake a lot of the time. Like listening to Empire Burlesque all the way through is kind of a fool's errand. It's more than I can take. Whereas listening to an individual song from Empire Burlesque,
that's right.
You know, just listening to Clean Cut Kid, you know, on its own, I think it's great. But when it's in the middle of the album, I'm already exhausted, and I think it's sort of trite. But I should put everything on shuffle and start again, basically.
Yeah, I mean, I find it a great way to live, especially when you've done a lot of it, as we have, and what I find so, what I love about Dylan is the great revivification that he brings, not just to his work, but to your life as the listener. Because he's about reinvention, he's about revivification. He's got this incredible ability to, even when he just lie down and die, man, you're 75, you've done the best work in the world. He says, no, I've got another album. I've got this new thing called Rough and Rowdy Ways. You've got to listen to it, guys. And you're like, whoa. And we, as humble partakers in his art, get some of that intravenous, whatever it is, intravenous revivification into our veins. So I'm sitting around like listening to that thing on the train. Everyone's in masks when it came out. And I'm thinking, my God, this man's alive. This man is so alive. And it made me feel revivified, made me feel like, okay, you've got to keep going. You've got to be not afraid. You've got to turn up. For me, that's a blank page. For you guys, it's a new show. Turn up. And damn well do it, you know. And you listen to that thing, that amazingly haunting song, where he talks about he's been putting livers and hearts and bones.
Yes.
And he's got it all together. And you realize he's not lying. It's just that's how he somehow got it. You know, my own version of you. I'm trying to remember the word. It's the album I know least well because I just haven't had enough time to listen to it. But, you know, when he says, all through the summers, that's it. I've been visiting morgues and monasteries,
yeah,
looking for the necessary. And that's about songwriting. Mm. And somehow, right at the end of his life, he's got a Frankenstein. And he's put it all back together. And he's got electricity. And he's jump-started it. And the damn thing's standing up and staggering through the world again. And you're like, wow, he's done it. He's done it. He's got himself going. There's a Frankenstein Dylan abroad. And he's alive, and I'm going to have to go and see him if I get a chance. And I'll be back at the shows the minute he starts performing again. I love the joy and the revivification and the energy that he brings to his listeners' lives as well. I mean, here we are, you know, the three of us sitting around animatedly talking about this stuff, and there's hundreds of thousands of people like us, and that's just the great thing about his work is it keeps you keeping on. You really want to know what's going on. I mean, you know. Is he going to play the piano like Leon Russell next time I see him, or what? What is this album about? What's going on? And he's brought it to life, and he's spared no expense, and he's done it with decency and common sense and all the things he says. And here we are. And he's like, yeah, but in the wee small hours, I did this, man. I reinvigorated my whole artistic form. And guess what, guys? You can listen. And I love that. I love that. I think that's a profound artistic gift to give to your generation and the generations to come. And that's why I think he's if anything, I was joking in an email to you, I think he's underrated.
Is It Rolling Bob, Talking Dylan, is recorded on Zencaster, stuck inside immobile.
Engineered by Mark Langley Smith and produced by Robin Guise. Digital imaging by Finn Guise. Music is by Sam Hare.
We're part of Pantheon Podcasts, the music podcast network.
Find us on Twitter at IsItRollingPod.
Well, the last thing I remember before I stripped and kneeled was that trainload of fools bogged down in a magnetic field. A gypsy with a broken flag and a flashing ring said, "Son, this ain't a dream no more. It's the real thing."